Hello, everyone. Alicia here. Okay, I'm excited. We're gonna go deep. This is The Seat of the Soul by Gary Zukav. And I'm gonna read the introduction to it and kind of stop here and there and talk about it a bit. But yeah, this is good stuff. Get ready. Okay, he offers us a new perspective on how to go forward. And you're going to see how this ties into everything else that we're talking about. Okay, this is chapter one called Evolution. The evolution that we learned about in school is the evolution of physical form. We learned, for example, that the single-celled creatures of the oceans are the predecessors of all more complex forms of life. A fish is more complex and therefore more evolved than a sponge. A horse is more complex and therefore more evolved than a snake. A monkey is more complex and therefore more evolved than a horse, and so on, up to human beings, which are the most complex and therefore the most evolved life forms on our planet. We were taught, in other words, that evolution means the progressive development of organizational complexity. This definition is an expression of the idea that the organism that is best able to control both its environment and all of the other organisms in its environment is the most evolved. Survival of the fittest means that the most evolved organism in a given environment is the organism that is at the top of the food chain in that environment. According to this definition, therefore, the organism that is most able to ensure its own survival, most able to serve its self-preservation, is the most evolved. We have long known that this definition of evolution is inadequate, he says, but we have not known why. Which, when I read this book, I was so intrigued because I knew it was inadequate, but I wasn't sure why. I was like, please tell me. Okay, when two humans engage one another, they are, in terms of organizational complexity, equally evolved. If both have the same intelligence, yet one is small-minded, mean, and selfish, while the other is magnanimous and altruistic, we say that the one who is magnanimous and altruistic is the more evolved. If one human intentionally sacrifices his or her life to save another, by, for example, using his or her own body to shield another from a bullet or a speeding car, we say that the human who sacrificed his or her life, indeed, was one of the most evolved among us. We know these things to be true, but they are at variance with our understanding of evolution. Jesus, we are told, foresaw the plot against his life, even to the details of how his friends would act and react, yet he did not run from what he saw. The entirety of humankind has been inexorably shaped by the power and love of one who gave his life for others. All who revere him, and almost all who but know his story, agree that he was one of the most evolved of our species. Our deeper understanding tells us that a truly evolved being is one that values others more than it values itself, and that lo values love more than it values the physical world and what is in it. We must now bring our understanding of evolution into alignment with this deeper understanding. It is important that we do this because our current understanding of evolution reflects the phase of evolution that we are now leaving. By examining this understanding, we can perceive how we have evolved to now and what we are now in the process of leaving behind. By reflecting upon a new and expanded understanding of evolution, one that validates our deepest truths, we can see what we are evolving into and what that means in terms of what we experience, what we value, and how we act. Yes, we are at a turning point. And now this virus is making it apparent. What many knew is becoming apparent to all. Okay, our current understanding of evolution results from the fact that we have evolved until now by exploring physical reality with our five senses. We have been, until now, five-sensory human beings. This path of evolution has allowed us to see the basic principles of the universe in concrete ways. We see through our five senses that every action is a cause, it has an effect, and that every effect has a cause. We see the results of our intentions. We see that rage kills, it takes away breath, the life force, and it spills blood, the carrier of vitality. We see that kindness nurtures. We see and feel the effects of a snarl and a smile. We experience our ability to process knowledge. We see, for example, that a stick is a tool, and we see the effects of how we choose to use it. The club that kills can drive a stake into the ground to hold a shelter. The spear that takes a life can be used as a lever to ease life's burdens. The knife that cuts flesh can be used to cut cloth. The hands that build bonds can be used to build schools. The minds that coordinate the activities of violence can coordinate the activities of cooperation. We see that when the activities of life are infused with reverence, they come alive with meaning and purpose. We see that when reverence is lacking from life's activities, the result is cruelty, violence, and loneliness. The physical arena is a magnificent learning environment. It is a school within which, through experimentation, we come to understand what causes us to expand and what causes us to contract. What causes us to grow and what causes us to shrivel, what nourishes our souls and what depletes them, what works and what does not. He says the physical arena is the magnificent learning environment. It is a school. Okay. When the physical environment is seen only from the five sensory point of view, physical survival appears to be the fundamental criterion of evolution because no other kind of evolution is detectable. It is from this point of view that survival of the fittest appears to be synonymous with evolution, and physical dominance appears to characterize advanced evolution. When perception of the physical world is limited to the five sensory modality, the basis of life in the physical arena becomes fear. Power to control the environment and those within the environment appears to be essential. The basis of life in the physical arena becomes fear. And power to control the environment is what helps you achieve that goal. Okay. The need for physical dominance produces a type of competition that affects every aspect of our lives. And that's brought us to where we are now. It affects relationships between lovers and between superpowers, between siblings and between races, between classes and between sexes. It disrupts the natural tendency toward harmony between nations and between friends. The same energy that sent warships to the Persian Gulf sent soldiers to Vietnam and crusaders to Palestine. The energy that separated the family of Romeo from the family of Juliet is the same energy that separates the racial family of the black husband from the racial family of the white wife. The energy that set Lee Harvey Oswald against John Kennedy is the same energy that set Cain against Abel. Brothers and sisters quarrel for the same reason that corporations quarrel. They seek power over one another. The power to control the environment and those within it is power over what can be felt, smelled, tasted, heard, or seen. This type of power is external power. External power can be acquired or lost, as in the stock market or an election. It can be bought or stolen, transferred, or inherited. It is thought of as something that can be gotten from someone else or somewhere else. One person's gain of external power is perceived as another person's loss. The result of seeing power as external is violence and destruction. All of our institutions, social, economic, and political, reflect our understanding of power as external. All of our institutions today, social, economic, political, reflect our understanding of power as external. That's important. I'll let him say why. Okay, then we'll unpack it a bit. Families, like cultures, are patriarchal or matriarchal. One person wears the pants. Children learn this early and it shapes their lives. Police departments, like the military, are produced by the perception of power as external. Badges, boots, rank, radio, uniform, weapons, and armor are symbols of fear. Those who wear them are fearful. They fear to engage the world without defenses. Those who encounter these symbols are fearful. They fear the power that these symbols represent, or they fear those whom they expect this power to contain, or they fear both. The police and the military, like patriarchal and matriarchal families and cultures, are not origins of the perception of power as external. They are reflections of the way that we, as a species and as individuals, have come to view power. The perception of power as external has shaped our economics. The ability to control economics within communities and within nations, and the ability to control the transnational economy of the world, is concentrated in the hands of a few people. To protect workers from these people, we have created unions. To protect consumers, we have created bureaucracies and government. To protect the poor, we have created welfare systems. This is a perfect reflection of how we have come to perceive power as the possession of a few while the majority serve it as victims. Money is a symbol of external power. Those who have the most money have the most ability to control their environment and those within it, while those who have the least money have the least ability to control their environment and those within it. Money is acquired, lost, stolen, inherited, and fought for. Education, social status, fame, and things that are owned. If we derive a sense of increased security from them, are symbols of external power. Anything we fear to lose, a home, a car, an attractive body, an agile mind, a deep belief, is a symbol of external power. What we fear is an increase in our vulnerability. This results from seeing power as external. When power is seen as external, the hierarchies of our social, economic, and political structures, as well as the hierarchies of the universe, appear as indicators of who has power and who does not. Those at the top appear to have the most power, and therefore to be the most valuable and the least vulnerable. Those at the bottom appear to be the least powerful, and therefore to be the least valuable and the most vulnerable. From this perception, the general is more valuable than the private, the executive is more valuable than the chauffeur, the doctor is more valuable than the receptionist, the parent is more valuable than the child, and the divine is more valuable than the worshiper. We fear to transgress our parents, our bosses, and our God. All perceptions of lesser and greater personal value result from the perception of power as external. And this is so important, right? If you've heard me talk about fear and love and separation and connection. Yeah. Okay. But I love his summary here, just helping us reflect on seeing this through the lens of power and just seeing kind of how valuing things in a certain way got us to where we are. Because that can help us talk about how to change how we go forward, right? We've got to change how we see things in order to change our reality. Competition for external power lies at the heart of all violence. The secondary gain behind ideological conflicts, such as capitalism versus communism, and religious conflicts, such as Irish Catholic versus Irish Protestant, and geographical conflicts, such as Jew versus Arab, and familial and marital conflicts, is external power. Oh, this is good. Okay, he says, the perception of power as external splinters the psyche, whether it is the psyche of the individual, the community, the nation, or the world. Viewing power as outside of yourself splinters your psyche. There is no difference between acute schizophrenia and a world at war. There is no difference between the agony of a splintered soul and the agony of a splintered nation. When a husband and a wife compete for power, they engage the same dynamic that humans of one race do when they fear humans of another race. From these dynamics, we have formed our present understanding of evolution as a process of ever-increasing ability to dominate the environment and each other. This definition reflects the limitations of perceiving the physical world with only five senses. It reflects the competition for external power that is generated by fear. After millennia of brutality to one another, individual to individual, and group to group, it is now clear that the insecurity which underlies the perception of power as external cannot be healed by the accumulation of external power. It is evident for all to see, not only with each newscast and evening paper, but also through each of our countless sufferings as individuals and as a species, that the perception of power as external brings only pain, violence, and destruction. This is how we have evolved until now, and this is what we are leaving behind. Yes. Our deeper understanding leads us to another kind of power, a power that loves life in every form that it appears, a power that does not judge what it encounters, a power that perceives meaningfulness and purpose in the smallest details upon the earth. This is authentic power. When we align our thoughts, emotions, and actions with the highest part of ourselves, we are filled with enthusiasm, purpose, and meaning. Life is rich and full. We have no thoughts of bitterness. We have no memory of fear. We are joyously and intimately engaged with our world. This is the experience of authentic power. Authentic power has its roots in the deepest source of our being. Authentic power cannot be bought, inherited, or hoarded. An authentically empowered person is incapable of making anyone or anything a victim. An authentically empowered person is one who is so strong, so empowered, that the idea of using force against another is not a part of his or her consciousness. It's not a part of their vocabulary. No understanding of evolution is adequate that does not have at its core that we are on a journey toward authentic power. So he says there's a whole nother level of our journey that cannot be explained or understood by this materialistic external perspective that so far has dominated our culture, right? That understanding of evolution is not adequate. We are on a journey toward authentic power. And that authentic empowerment is the goal of our evolutionary process and the purpose of our being. Okay, we are evolving from a species that pursues external power into a species that pursues authentic power. We are a species that has valued external power because of our understanding of the world. It's time for our understanding of the world to change and transform. And as a result, we're going to learn to pursue authentic power, which is motivated by love instead of fear. We are leaving behind exploration of the physical world as our sole means of evolution. This means of evolution and the consciousness that results from an awareness that is limited to the five sensory modality are no longer adequate to what we must become. We are evolving from five sensory humans into multi-sensory humans. Our five senses together form a single sensory system that is designed to perceive physical reality. The perceptions of a multi-sensory human extend beyond physical reality to the larger dynamical systems of which our physical reality is a part. Energy and spirit. The multisensory human is able to perceive and to appreciate the role that our physical reality plays in a larger picture of evolution and the dynamics by which our physical reality is created and sustained. This realm is invisible to the five sensory human. It is in this invisible realm that the origins of our deepest values are found. Our values are formed and come from the invisible world because, if you've heard me talk at all, it's because we're energy and we came from energy and we manifested in this physical form for a season, for a reason. Okay. From the perspective of this invisible realm, the spiritual, the energetic realm, the motivations of those who consciously sacrifice their lives for higher purposes make sense. The power of Gandhi is explicable, and the compassionate acts of the Christ are comprehensible in a fullness that is not accessible to the five sensory human. All of our great teachers have been or are multisensory humans. They have spoken to us and acted in accordance with perceptions and values that reflect the larger perspective of the multisensory being, and therefore their words and actions awaken within us the recognition of truths. From the perception of the five-sensory human, we are alone in a universe that is physical. From the perception of the multisensory human, we are never alone, and the universe is alive, conscious, intelligent, and compassionate. That's God. From the perception of the five-sensory human, the physical world is an unaccountable given in which we unaccountably find ourselves, and we strive to dominate it so that we can survive. From the perception of the multisensory human, the physical world is a learning environment that is created jointly by the souls that share it, and everything that occurs within it serves their learning. Okay, stop. That's the shift. Okay, so he says five-sensory and multisensory. But I want to talk about this in terms of kind of a naturalistic view versus a supernatural view. Okay, so the physical world is an unaccountable given in which we unaccountably find ourselves and we strive to dominate it so that we can survive from that perspective. But our new perspective, through a spiritual view, is that this physical world is a learning environment that is created jointly by the souls that share it, and everything that occurs within it serves their learning. So instead of victims, we are part of the creators. Our souls create this reality in order to grow and heal and learn. Okay, he says, from the perception of the five-sensory human, intentions have no effects. The effects of actions are physical, and not all actions affect us or others. From the perception of the multisensory human, the intention behind an action determines its effects. Every intention affects both us and others, and the effects of intentions extend far beyond the physical world. Because everything is energy and everything is connected, right? What does it mean to say that an invisible realm exists in which the origins of our deeper understandings are located? What are the implications of considering the existence of a realm that is not detectable through the five senses, but that can be known, explored, and understood by other human faculties, by your soul, by your spirit, by your spiritual knowing that will awaken when you choose to experience that higher realm? When a question is asked that cannot be answered within the common frame of reference, it can be classified as nonsensical, or it can be dismissed as a question that is not appropriate, or the person who is asking the question can expand his or her consciousness to encompass a frame of reference from which the question can be answered. So he's saying when you ask a question that cannot be answered within your current frame of reference, you can say it's ridiculous, or you could expand your current frame of reference to something that makes space for it, right? The first two options are the easy ways out of a confrontation with a question that appears to be nonsensical or appropriate. But the seeker, the true scientist, will allow himself or herself to expand into a frame of reference from which the answers that he or she is seeking can be understood. Which is why Rob Bell encourages us to be open, right? To be open. All the authors that I read, they start by saying, okay, be open to this. Consider the mystery. Be open to things being bigger, brighter, more complex and beautiful and paradoxical than you realized. We, as a species, have been asking the questions, is there a God? Is there a divine intelligence? And is there a purpose to life? For as long as we've been able to articulate questions. The time has now come for us to expand into a frame of reference that allows these questions to be answered. The larger frame of reference of the multisensory human allows an understanding of the experientially meaningful distinction between the personality and the soul. Okay, so he introduces this concept of the personality and the soul. Your personality is that part of you that was born into, lives within, and will die within time. To be a human and to have a personality are the same thing. Your personality, like your body, is the vehicle of your evolution. The decisions that you make and the actions that you take upon the earth are the means by which you evolve. At each moment, you choose the intentions that will shape your experiences and those things upon which you will focus your attention. These choices affect your evolutionary process. This is so for each person. If you choose unconsciously, you evolve unconsciously. If you choose consciously, you evolve consciously. The fearful and violent emotions that have come to characterize human existence can be experienced only by the personality. Only the personality can feel anger, fear, hatred, vengeance, sorrow, shame, regret, indifference, frustration, cynicism, and loneliness. Only the personality can judge, manipulate, and exploit. Only the personality can pursue external power. Which is why Eckhart Tolle and Wayne Dyer both talk about being the watcher of your thinking and being cultivating the witness, because your soul can watch your personality. Your soul does not judge. Your soul is love. Your soul is unattached. Your soul is the watcher. And your personality can feel all these emotions of the ego and the false self. Only the personality can pursue external power, because the soul is authentic power. Okay, he says, the personality can also be loving, compassionate, and wise in its relations with others, but love, compassion, and wisdom do not come from the personality. They are experiences of the soul. Okay, now he's going to talk about the soul. Your soul is that part of you that is immortal. Every person has a soul, but a personality that is limited in its perception to the five senses is not aware of its soul, and therefore cannot recognize the influences of its soul. A personality becomes multisensory. Its intuitions, its hunches, and subtle feelings become important to it. It senses things about itself, other people, and the situations in which it finds itself that it cannot justify on the basis of the information that its five senses can provide. So he's talking about spiritual awakening. As a personality begins to awaken to the soul, it has intuitions and hunches and feelings that doesn't match its former paradigm, right? Okay, he says, it comes to recognize intentions and to respond to them rather than to the actions and the words that it encounters. It can recognize, for example, a warm heart beneath a harsh and angry manner and a cold heart beneath polished and pleasing words, right? So experiencing the world energetically instead of at face value, right? When a multisensory personality looks inside itself, it finds a multitude of different currents. Through experience, it learns to distinguish between these currents and to identify the emotional, psychological, and physical effects of each. So he's talking about self-mastery. Spiritual awakening is self-mastery. You are no longer just driven unconsciously by the ego, but you begin to recognize the different influences and the different voices inside your mind, right? You watch it and you become aware, and then you can influence it, and you can flip the switch, and you can turn the dial and switch the way that you, Through experience, it learns to distinguish between these currents and to identify the emotional, psychological, and physical effects of each. It learns, for example, which currents produce anger, divisive thoughts, and destructive actions, and which currents produce love, healing thoughts, and constructive actions. In time, it learns to value and to identify with those currents that generate creativity, healing, and love, and to challenge and release those currents that create negativity, disharmony, and violence. In this way, a personality comes to experience the energy of its soul. Your soul is not a passive or a theoretical entity that occupies a space in the vicinity of your chest cavity. It is a positive person. Okay, your soul. It is a positive, purposeful force at the core of your being. It is that part of you that understands the impersonal nature of the energy dynamics in which you are involved, that loves without restriction and accepts without judgment. If you desire to know your soul, the first step is to recognize that you have a soul. The next step is to allow yourself to consider, if I have a soul, what is my soul? What does my soul want? What is the relationship between my soul and me? How does my soul affect my life? When the energy of the soul is recognized, acknowledged, and valued, it begins to infuse the life of the personality. When the personality recognizes the energy of the soul, they begin to come together. When the personality comes fully to serve the energy of its soul, that is authentic empowerment. So he describes authentic empowerment, which is the goal, as the alignment of our personality with our soul. And I would agree. His use of terms and that metaphor is interesting. But yes, I would agree. This is the goal of the evolutionary process in which we are involved and the reason for our being. Every experience that you have and will have upon the earth encourages the alignment of your personality with your soul. That's why you're here. Every circumstance and situation gives you the opportunity to choose this path, to allow your soul to shine through you, to bring into the physical world through you its unending and unfathomable reverence for and love of life. This is a book about authentic empowerment, the alignment of the personality with the soul, what that involves, how it happens, and what it creates. To understand these things requires an understanding of things that appear unusual to the five-sensory human, but they become natural once you understand evolution. That five-sensory perception is a journey leading to multisensory perception, and that you are not always meant to be five sensory. So if you read my book or some of it, the first part, I'm just trying to describe in different words the same shift as he is describing. But every author provides us with useful perspective and useful language, and what the two takeaways that I want to just share real quick from his are this idea of external power and authentic power or internal power. When we talk about Carolyn Miss, she will flesh out that idea a lot. I like his introduction to it and the way he kind of intertwines the idea of power and this pursuit of external power with evolution and the journey of our species so far. And kind of he ties it into history. When we get to Carolyn Miss, she really talks about power in an experiential way and how we personally relate to this dynamic of power in the world. And she talks about how everything is kind of transactions of power, influenced by power. But then his other concept, so he talks about evolution and power, but then he talks about the personality and the soul, right? So we've talked about the soul some, we talked about the ego. The soul is your divine, the part of you that is divine and eternal and spiritual and energetic, right? That came to be in a body. And when that soul that is spirit comes to be a human, it wraps itself in a personality for this experience. And part of the personality has a relationship with the ego. And so the ego is that false self that is separated from God. When you forget your soul and then you recover your soul. Because when you were born, if you knew everything that your soul knows, you couldn't have the journey here that your soul came to have, right? So our awakening our awakening is the natural process that we are meant to have. And we have experiences, most of us. Some awaken very early, but we have experiences that are meant to be part of our journey. And then as we heal things, that's an experience that our soul was meaning to have in this lifetime. And so whenever we're in the state where we don't remember our soul, or we're separate from our soul and we don't remember that truth, then we have to replace that. We need an identity. We have to replace that with something. And so that's the ego. It's the false self. And our world is dominated by that thought pattern of the ego. And so we are taught that. And then the unlearning of that fear, that ego, that false self, is the spiritual awakening. It's the unlearning of fear and you know, replacing that with love, as Marianne Williamson says. So, but what I think is interesting, this idea of the personality, if I like pink and butterflies, that's not ego, that's not false self, that's not necessarily illusion, in the way that fear is illusion in a spiritual sense. That is true about me, but, you know, is that is a consequence. It's a physical manifestation of the expression of my spirit and my soul in this physical realm. And so when I die and I return to spirit, will that still be true? Well, that won't be applicable, right? So that's part of my personality. So I think there's a beautiful spiritual truth, a nuance here that I like how the personality idea helps us fill out, is just this truth of, as we explore, part of the spiritual awakening and spiritual journey is exploring and understanding and coming to ownership and peace with your own identity. And I just think we talk a lot about ego and soul, and I think this concept of personality, one thing that it gives us is this way to understand that there are parts of us that are just neutral in a sense, but beneficial and sources of joy, because beauty is a spiritual concept. But what I find beautiful is an expression of my personality. And that is part of the beautiful expression of who I am in this existence. And Wayne Dyer talks about, you know, you're an eternal being having a human experience, and how when you have that realization, Eckhart Tolle says, die to yourself now and realize that you haven't died, so that you've already made peace with death, right? The spiritual teachers talk about making peace with death. When you do that, then you can live from this incredible space of peace that your soul existed before you now, and that your soul will continue to exist. And so you can release that fear of death. And the way that you find that is you shift your identity from the false self and the ego, which will die with your body. You shift your identity from that false self that will die to your soul that will not die. And that shift in identity is how you release that fear of death, right? You identify with that part of yourself, which will not die. So you find peace in that, but there's still a beautiful truth that I, in our personality, in this expression in time right now, will never happen again. You are a unique expression in time. Your soul coming into this situation to inhabit this body and be this personality, it is a unique experience in time, and it's a gift, and it is meant to be something. So both are true. All right. I want to wrap this up. This is such a profound, crucial piece in the big picture of what we're talking about, but I'm thinking about how I can make this practical. I don't know. We went deep on this. So I want to encourage you to just take time to meditate and journal. And I think the practical application for this is to practice being open, practice openness, going deep and changing our paradigm of theology and history and psychology, and just in this kind of way, changing our perspective on life to such a deep core, it's such a deep core internal level, it stretches your psyche. So I want to speak grace to you. I speak grace, God's grace, for the process, and I want you to ask for grace to set your intention to be open, to embrace openness, and to relax into it, to let go of striving, to let go of mentally thinking, okay, I can understand this, I want to understand this. Let go of the striving and receive the truth that shifting your paradigms, your perspective on life, it's deep and it's intense, and it's not to be taken lightly, but it's still something as everything. It's still something that can be received with ease and joy. So I want to speak peace and ease and joy and openness to you. May the grace of God be with you as you ease into this transition of spiritual awakening and shifting your paradigm. All right, that's all for now. All my love. If you are not yet on my email list, just head over to aliciasouladventure.com and sign up. Come along for the journey with us. And until next time. All right, bye.